Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. As I've been getting more feedback, I remember that I have to introduce myself at the beginning of podcasts a little bit more. So like I said, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to the Total EM podcast, for which there is also a blog. You just go to totalem.org. And in addition, I help educate people through Practical Pocus, which is an ultrasound education company. You can go to practicalpocus.com to learn more about it. But I wanted to cover something that we have only touched a little bit about in the last podcast, and that was all about ATLS, talking about shock and management there. But in that series, I just kind of briefly mentioned about the use of vasopressors, specifically vasopressin, during shock management for trauma. And I mentioned how there's not a ton of evidence there, but that it could be used in certain circumstances. And I wanted to take a little bit of a deeper dive into this subject because I think most of us are not very familiar with the literature and what this actually means and why giving pressors may be actually a good idea depending on the situation. Again, I have to emphasize that there is very limited evidence in this role. And I'm not necessarily saying one way or the other what is going to be the best way of management because there's just not a ton of evidence. I will tell you that in certain circumstances, it seems like there are going to be times when pressors are most beneficial, but this doesn't change the core management, which is all about identifying, controlling bleeding and definitive control of that bleeding. So usually this is going to be surgery of some kind and replacing the lost blood. So giving blood products. While some people will still talk about crystalloids, I am not a huge fan of it because it doesn't necessarily help in the way that we need it to help. It's one thing to give some crystalloids, such as normal saline, when you are giving medications, such as tranexamic acid or cefazolin, that you need to give during the middle of the management. But by itself, I don't really find the use for it. And I think the evidence is really strong about any benefit of giving crystalloids versus blood products. But the blood products are at least replacing what the body is losing, and I think it's better for that reason. Like I said, there may still be a role for pressors. So let's talk a little bit more about that. Really, this is only something that's more of a last-ditch effort. So in certain circumstances, such as the rural or austere environments or any other limited resource settings, you are going to have only a finite supply of blood if any blood products are available. How do you get that person then to get through that stage? Well, this may be a time when crystalloids may be appropriate, but if possible, I would rather give less crystalloids and more of a vasopressor, assuming that the tank is full enough to actually, you know, pump something through it. And this is where things get a little more interesting because, like I said, there's really not evidence in the first place, but what evidence does exist usually comes out of a trauma center setting. So we really don't know how much this would change using pressors or blood products or something else in a rural setting or a limited resource setting versus your top of the line level one trauma center. As a transition point, let's talk about the actual pathophysiology of hemorrhagic shock and where vasopressors may play a role in this. With hemorrhagic shock, catecholamines such as epinephrine and norepinephrine are released at 10 to 40 times their normal levels during hemorrhage. There is also a delayed activation of the renin-angiotensin system, and this leads to vasoconstriction, which allows for blood pressure to be maintained even with as much as 30% blood volume being lost before any signs or symptoms of shock appear. The vasoconstriction can also lead to end organ ischemia and impaired oxygen delivery, which leads to anaerobic metabolism that will lead to metabolic acidosis, and in turn, the acidosis can downregulate vasopressor receptors. This is something where I never thought in this podcast I'd actually have a benefit for, but we're going to talk about the citric acid cycle or tricarboxylic acid cycle. You may think to yourself, what is that? What is this TCA cycle or this citric acid cycle? For those of you who've been around for a little bit, like me, you may remember the Krebs cycle. Yes, We make jokes all the time about how we have to learn the Krebs cycle, and it probably doesn't have any real role in medicine as far as like anything that clinically is going to matter on a day-to-day basis. But this may actually be a time when it's worth digging that back out again and realizing that there is some role. Thank God I don't have to go into any real detail about the Krebs cycle. But if you could just remember just enough to go back to that citric acid cycle and the oxidative phosphorylation, you may remember that it produces 38 adenosine triphosphate or ATP molecules. So 38 ATP in the traditional aerobic metabolic system. All right. And that ATP is the main source of energy for cellular activity. However, in oxygen-deprived tissue, pyruvate remains within the cytoplasm and converts to lactate in the process known as anaerobic glycolysis, which only produces 2 ATP, making it much less efficient. Like I said, worth remembering here for just a second. So that 38 ATP versus 2 ATP. If hemorrhagic shock persists, the cellular membrane loses the ability to maintain its integrity, leading to cellular damage, edema, and death, all relating back to the fact that not as much ATP is being produced. So the workhorse of the system, the energy that is needed to keep the cells going, is not really being produced at the same level. In turn, a variety of vasodilatory mediators resulting from ischemia reperfusion injury may be released. And as a reminder of those, because that may be something else that you've kind of forgotten about with time, those are like leukotrienes, interleukins, thromboxane, prostaglandin, prostacyclins, tumor necrosis factor, and complements. Decompensation will follow this vasodilation and hypotension, which will not respond to crystalloid fluids or blood products. And this will eventually lead to end organ damage and multi-organ dysfunction syndrome. As this all ties into a role, this may be where we start finding the benefits of vasopressors. But let's talk about the two main ones, norepinephrine and then vasopressin itself. We're going to talk about norepinephrine first, but keep in mind that with most of the studies, either with norepinephrine or vasopressin, they're actually animal studies. There are some observation studies in humans, both in norepinephrine and vasopressin, and there's only one randomized control trial that I could see with vasopressin, which may help edge out a little bit why it's the better one, but more on that here in just a few minutes. Norepinephrine has become more and more widely used in shock states, especially septic shock. It is a sympathomimetic agent that is acting on alpha adrenergic receptors in both veins and arteries. This leads to increased vasoconstriction in arteries, which increases the blood pressure directly. Venoconstriction, especially in the splanchnic circulation, causes a shift of venous blood back into systemic circulation and increases the circulating blood volume in the central compartment, thus maintaining blood flow to the vital organs. In addition, venous return is increased due to decreased venous resistance caused by the stimulation of beta adrenergic receptors. Norepinephrine can also improve the cardiac index and coronary perfusion. It will increase cerebral perfusion pressure, but does not improve cerebral oxygenation until there is transfusion of blood products. And renal perfusion is also increased with an improvement in creatinine clearance. Really, the only studies we have are in rats, mice, and pigs. And what we find in those studies is that there are decreased amounts of fluids that are needed to achieve the target blood pressure with less blood loss when norepinephrine is used. And it does also appear to be that there's not really any true tissue ischemia due to the excessive arteriolar vasoconstriction during hemorrhagic shock when norepinephrine is used. This information has led to the European guidelines formulated by the Multidisciplinary Task Force for Advanced Bleeding Care and Trauma to recommend the use of norepinephrine as the primary agent to be used to maintain target blood pressures, which are often 80 to 90 millimeters mercury systolic. However, this should only be used in the absence of a response to fluid therapy. They do acknowledge in these same guidelines that cardiac dysfunction could be altered due to cardiac contusion, pericardial effusion, or intracranial hemorrhage. And in those cases where cardiac dysfunction is recognized, they actually recommend that using an inotropic agent such as dobutamine or epinephrine could be beneficial. I didn't really find hardly any evidence to actually support this role, but I understand in the physiological sense and the mechanism of action why they would recommend an inotrope in those situations. But just keep in mind, there is like really basically no real evidence supporting the use of inotropes in hemorrhagic shock with cardiac dysfunction. I think really just because it really hasn't been studied, not necessarily because it's not good, but there just really isn't any evidence behind it. So let's shift to something with a little more evidence, and that's vasopressin. The use of vasopressin is growing thanks to some new evidence, but we need to start with the basics. It is an endogenous neurohypophyseal hormone, which acts on V1 receptors in blood vessels and shunts blood from skin, splenic, and skeletal areas to the heart and brain, thus maintaining perfusion of vital organs. It also restores blood back to the kidney and liver and decreases the mesenteric and portal blood flow. And this may be useful in intra-abdominal bleeding, given its decreased mesenteric perfusion, which would limit blood flow to the involved areas. Also, vasopressin may improve hemostasis by enhancing platelet function and thus augmenting clot formation. Something that I didn't really know about, or at least I don't remember until I started to dive into this subject a little bit more. It's really helpful in physiologic dosing, which is 0.04 units per minute or less, because at this range, it does not augment blood pressure in healthy volunteers, based on some studies, and only acts as a vasopressor in deficient states. Why I find that really helpful is because it's something you can kind of turn on and almost leave be in some ways, because it's really probably just going to help those who are sick, you know, those who are lacking enough vasopressin, which in hemorrhagic shock is suspected. And that ties in a little bit to the trial we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. There are quite a few pig studies, though, that have found benefits in vasopressin. So one study resulted in a higher mean arterial pressure, or MAP, and survival with full recovery compared to fluid resuscitation or placebo. It was also found in another study to have a higher MAP and improved organ blood flow without aggravating further blood loss in the vasopressin group compared to the fluid resuscitation or placebo group. And then there's a third study that found that vasopressin was better than epinephrine in hemorrhagic shock and cardiac arrest, with all the pigs in the epinephrine group dying within 60 minutes and all the treated pigs with vasopressin surviving. Again, this evidence is not a ton, but it was enough to support the recommendation of using vasopressin in hemorrhagic or hypovolemic shock, because they tied those two together, for Canadian emergency departments by the Critical Care Practice Committee of the Association of Emergency Physicians. But like I said, there's actually now even stronger evidence to support the use of vasopressin. There was a randomized controlled trial in humans that was published last year known as the AVERT trial, and that was published by Sims et al. In JAMA Surgery. They randomized 100 adult trauma patients in hemorrhagic shock to receive either vasopressin as a bolus with an infusion thereafter versus a placebo bolus and infusion. And they had a positive primary outcome by demonstrating that vasopressin significantly reduced the volume of blood products that were transfused in the first 48 hours. None of the secondary outcomes, though, including 30-day mortality, which I think was the most important one in my eyes, because that is truly a patient-oriented outcome, was different between the two groups, the placebo versus vasopressin. Interestingly, there was no difference in adverse events except for a significantly reduced rate of DVTs, 20 versus 39%, favoring vasopressin. So this is something that I don't know if this is just something that was just by chance and maybe is not truly the case, especially when you consider that the study was only of 100 trauma patients, but that's a pretty significant difference. I mean, we're talking about, in theory, a number needed to treat of 5 to have this. So this is something, like I said, it's too small to really actually get good information on this. And I think that's something that's really important, is that while this was a very well done study, it is limited because it was not powered to assess for truly adverse events, because you usually need thousands of people to do that or to find a survival benefit. However, I think that future randomized controlled trials should focus in on looking at direct patient-oriented outcomes, including survival, because really that's the biggest one we care about, is will us giving a vasopressor improve their survival rate, or can these people really tolerate this better than we assume? And those who are sick enough where they're going to need the pressor support, really, if they're going to live, they were going to live. And that's hard to know at this point. I should mention the dosing that they used in this, because I find this very important. They did a 4-unit bolus of vasopressin, and then they followed it by a 0.04 units per minute infusion, which goes back to that physiologic dosing we were talking about just a few minutes ago. And they could titrate it all the way down to zero to maintain a MAP of 65 or higher for the 48 hours following surgical control of the bleeding. I don't want to take a deeper dive into the AVERT shock trial just because there are so many great FOMED, free and open access medical education resources that have already covered it in great detail, including The Bottom Line, St. Imlin's, East TraumaCast, which included an interview with the author of the paper, and then Rebel EM, which also has some great feedback with trauma surgery. And like I said, these are ones that you should definitely check out and read through and listen to the related podcast, because I think you'll find a really nice deep dive into the subject to talk about the pros and cons of this paper. But just know that this was actually a pretty good study, given it was a single center trauma center. It really doesn't help us, again, answer what happens in resource limited settings, but it does give us some initial information to show that vasopressin does seem to help in certain circumstances. So what am I going to do about this for now? Realistically, we need more studies. We need larger and more robust studies. We need to look directly at patient-oriented outcomes. And I think the most important one is survival, because that's going to be the one that really is going to help us know, is this something that truly matters? You know, what other patient-oriented outcomes could be included is also kind of a separate issue. But for me, survival is the biggest one, because me as a patient, I want to know, is this going to help me? Am I going to get through because of this medication? And there may be other, again, patient-oriented outcomes that are important. If we find that there are truly consistent changes with the reduced rate of DVTs, that could also be really beneficial in these patients. Again, the way I'm going to look at this for now is that this helps support the practice that you could use vasopressors, specifically vasopressin, with at least some human data to support it. Should it be used all the time? No. Should it be used before you give blood products whenever possible? No. Really, again, you need to control the hemorrhage. So that bleeding control, especially definitive bleeding control with surgery, is key. And then replacing lost blood products, I think, is another key part. Yes, you could give crystalloids. ATLS will support you giving a certain amount of crystalloids. But realistically, I think what we should start seeing is more use of vasopressin and other vasopressors, depending on the evidence and what's going on at the time and availability of those resources, when these patients are not responding to the initial resuscitation attempts. And as one final note with that, I think norepinephrine could be a reasonable alternative. I'm not really sure about the whole inotrope use. I mean, given there are some recommendations out there, so it's something you could consider. But I really think that given the limited amount of evidence, I'm only going to use that in a very, very specific patient population. Hopefully this is helpful. This gives a little more detail as what we were talking about before. I would highly encourage you, as always, to check out the show notes, because at totalem.org, we have all the information, including the citations of the studies that we talked about today. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.